reflections, morning reflections, you can bring into your mind the way it is. During this past month, you've had a reflection for where you need, where weakness is. It's important to know where one's weaknesses are. If you don't, if you're proud or conceited, then of course you can't admit it. But to see where you tend to drift or get caught up into things or resist or defend or justify or just ignore, or just be insensitive. That's the value of community life, is that it gives us that reflection. If you just live on your own terms, by yourself, then you don't have any reflection for your life. You can live your life very much creating the ideas and views and justifying them without any kind of feedback. Now, because we are sensitive beings, this means that we can open the senses, not shut them off, but not for indulgence anymore, not to just distract the mind, but to begin to feel and relate to the way things are. Some people do this much more easily than others. Some people are so enclosed within their own mind and thought and viewpoint that they don't have much of a feeling for the way things are. They tend to always be projecting their own view onto the here and now. Other people are very sensitive to the way things are, but don't have wisdom to understand it. They pick up the feeling, the mood very quickly, but they don't have any wisdom to understand what it is or why. They just tend to misinterpret. Now, to keep everything in perspective, you have the reflection that all conditions are impermanent, all dhamma is not self. This keeps, if you use these two sentences for reflection, to interpret all experience, subjective or objective, then of course you always keep from getting far out, from being carried away by things. Because the conditions can be very subjective, very personal, very strong, very important, very urgent, very real. But if you, the reflection, all that comes goes, all that arises ceases, keeps all of it in perspective, not to mention the death of people we know and of changing conditions, situations, on just the practical living of life as it is. So even the most weird, far-out, subjective, irrational experiences work on the same principle as what they call normal, real life, the real world. Schizophrenic visions and ordinary daily thought about shopping in the supermarket, all are conditions that arise and cease in the mind. The Paitamanata, in Theravada, this emphasis on anatta is very valuable, really. Because there's a the tendency in religion is always to find oneself as something, to have a name. Even the Hindu go to I am one with Brahman or this kind of thing is never done, never stated in Buddhism. They say, tama anatta. They say, all dhamma is not self. I am one with the big self, or the Atman, and of the Hindu, is never done in Buddhism, because it's a practical way of reflection rather than a doctrine. So it's not that isn't true. It means, but it's to hold on to a view of I am one with the Brahman is another attachment to let go of. So the Buddha attacked at the point of where people attach rather than making doctrinal statements. Always looking at the attachment, the tendency to grasp, rather than trying to figure it out on doctrinal, metaphysical symbols for ultimate truth, ultimate reality. That's very wise to have steered away from that very strong tendency. I feel it in myself, in fact, to want to verbalize and conceptualize ultimate reality. So that the practice is always with the here and now rather than with some inspired thought about one with the ultimate or with the Brahman or the pure mind, or all these might be appropriate means of expression under specific circumstances, but are not to be made into doctrinal positions for Buddhists. The Buddhism stays away from that particular, that way of that kind of religious dogmatism. There is dukkha, it arises, it ceases, and there is the path. It's a reflection, isn't it? Not a doctrine, not a dogma to be believed in. It's a reflection on the way it is. So the practice is not giving things a second thought. Which is difficult. You can see leaping out of bed with alacrity is difficult to do if you can't do it if you think about it. Notice the way of practice is always through an openness rather than a closing. It's through generosity, through giving rather than through getting. These are important directions to look toward. Just from my own experience in watching others through the years, with the meditators, meditating can be a very selfish kind of attainment, where you try to get rather than give. sometimes people will come to me and they'll say, somebody will want to take an agarika ordination. They'll say, I want to, they think they're doing us a favor. So they'll say, I want to become an anagarika so I can get things here. There's a lot of things I can get here. What can I get here? Rather than they, may I join the community so can I help, so I can give? Now which of those two positions is the most beautiful as far as Dhamma goes, which tends to be one towards openness and generosity and all the qualities that are spiritual, and which is for selfish, immature kind of desires. See what I can get out of this place. Or what I've come here to give, to help, to serve. With some kinds of meditation, with samatha meditation, it's very much attaining and getting, isn't it? You close everything out, you shut everything out and concentrate. You have to be in a special place. Everything is excluding. So that's the nature of samatha. I found that if I did a lot of samatha practice, I became a very, very selfish person. This is just my experience. The more I did, the more tranquil I became with it, and then the more successful I was with it, then I was that much more selfish. There's always this wanting to protect and keep and get and attain and not be bothered, not have anyone impinge on my space, not have anyone make any unpleasant demands that would upset me to where I couldn't concentrate, where I find it difficult to concentrate. Now this is just not that anything wrong with doing samatha, but to know that attachment to samatha tends to make one that way. One can use samatha wisely or stupidly. It depends on the individual, doesn't it? That in itself is merely a convention, but it is concentrating the mind on one object, and so in order to do that you have to make your mind very small and you have to shut out and suppress everything else. So say if I concentrate on the candle flame, then I say if Bob should get up and walk in front of the candle and stand there, then I thought, he's blocking my concentration, get out of there. Because my mind is focused, is set on the candle flame, and then Bob stands in front of it, and he's blocking what I'm concentrating on. And then I get irritated and annoyed. If I'm attached to that, if I'm not mindful, if I'm just going doing this for the sake of concentrating my mind on something, but not knowing my intention, then of course I become irritated and annoyed by that. Well, when there's mindfulness, then one can concentrate doing samatha practice, but one is much more open to the way things go, so that any interference is a part of it all. It's not seen as something that is getting in the way anymore. because the object is not for attainment or making oneself happy and tranquil, but it's an exercise, a way of using conditions for concentrating the mind, for mindfulness, for opening the mind, because when you concentrate on the candle flame, you can open it, the mind, to the space around the flame, to the to anything that goes by, passes by, anything that stands in front. Because in mindfulness, it can, the full mind can, has room for everything in the whole universe. Now, referring back to the sound of silence, the breathing of the body, the posture. These are always going on. This is the way it is wherever you are. To have that is a kind of grounding reflection. Because candle flames and all these different objects can are very dependent. We can't always have candle flames or situations for concentrating the mind on one thing. If you're driving a car and you can't very well concentrate on one thing. You have to be very mindful. You have to open the mind to have that kind of alertness, attentiveness, in case, because of all the possibilities of dangerous potential in driving a car. You couldn't have a candle flame on the kind of dash and sit there concentrating on the candle flame while driving the car, could you? But you can listen to the sound of silence and still be completely with the driving and alert to anything that might happen during that time. To keep the mind from wandering around with your emotions and fears and desires is to constantly refer to that so that you're not indulging in the emotions. Now, emotions, we need to be honest with them, but there's a point where there's just immature kind of indulgence in them, and there's also the mature expression of emotion. So that emotions, if they're just something that we're indulging in, then it's because we're attached, we're giving them second thoughts, we're absorbing into them. But when they're seen for what they are, the anger or greed, any of these things, should, any form of emotional extremes start arising, one can actually go to the the feeling of it, the mood, and let go, rather than suppress or indulge. Now there's a lot, because we are human and we are tend to be conceited and proud and opinionated and all that, then it's sometimes very difficult because our feelings get hurt and we don't want to admit anything, or we feel we're being misunderstood or exploited by somebody else, or our rights are being impinged on, or people don't love us or appreciate us enough. And even if that's true, even if that should be true, it doesn't matter for the reflection on Dhamma, because it is still sape sankaranicca, sape tamanata. In our life here, it shouldn't be for being understood, being appreciated, being loved, being accepted, not being exploited, being given our due, and everything being fair and just. That's not what we're here for, is it? To have all the advantages, but to be enlightened, to see things as they are. So even injustice and unfairness can reflect for us the kind of conceit, pride, indignation, resentment, bitterness. These are still, if we get caught into these kind of moods, then we're not being mindful anymore. We're caught up into it. And of course, if I were persecuting one of you quite unfairly, you'd certainly feel it'd be justified, there'd be all kinds of justification in your indignation. But still, wisely reflecting, you it would be much better than to reflect on it wisely than to indulge in the feeling of indignation, the feeling of being persecuted or not appreciated. Let that go. It doesn't matter how much we are appreciated or not appreciated, as long as we get the message and see things clearly. Now that doesn't mean that we should go around persecuting each other or exploiting each other just to give each other this opportunity to let go. But inevitably, in a community life and in the world, one can have these feelings. One can feel this way, a very common way to feel for people. There's always going to be preferences and friendships and all these kind of relationships are part of life, so that it's just the way it is. The idea of being completely equal and everything the same is a very, very high-minded idea. But in actual experience, we find ourselves drawn to certain people than others, and more in tune with this and that, with that, and it's just the way it has to be. Doesn't mean that it'd be better if we could just be totally without any kind of just a kind of total blank, where one doesn't say have any even in the outward manifestation, any prefer one or feel more inclined to one over another. And in the long run, that's how it really has to be, in the sense of being fair and just. But just on say daily life experiences, just the way things are through karma and that, we have to bear with our own inclinations, preferences, tendencies, character traits, and all these are just something that we begin to reflect on rather than to make problems with. Rising up to be grander than rising up to the situation, to where we can open the mind completely to it, even to injustice, because the mind can hold injustice, can bear with injustice, persecution or exploitation, unfairness, intolerance, as well as their opposites. Talking about sadha or faith, this is, I think most of us tended to come into Buddhism more through panya than through sadha, much more the ability to, we like the, because of the development of critical faculties and that we appreciated the fact that we didn't have to believe in things, or there was not much demanded in Buddhism. In fact, like so much of Buddhism in the West is kind of a rejection of any kind of devotional practice. Talking about that yesterday, about Zen and the different forms of Buddhism that one finds in Europe and America, where the old kind of Asian value of devotion is hardly exists, or faith. Mm-hmm. Talking about Venerable Sujita, about somebody's experience in America of going to Buddhist groups where they tend to kind of make fun of things, make wisecracks. Americans have to make wisecracks about everything. so that if it's a serious kind of situation or what demands devotion, it, one tends to make fun of it or lampoon, kind of destroy its sanctity or its seriousness with a trivial joke, which people tend to think is not being attached to tradition or not being blindly believing or devoted. But that is, I don't think that blind belief and devotion are things that most of us have great problems with. They're not particularly blinded by devotion or belief, say, as you might find in a Buddhist country where people are brought up in believing in all kinds of things about Buddhism. But our approach generally is one through the critical faculty. So trivialization and irreverence and sacrilegious attitudes are very common to us. It's very easy to talk about, at a costume party, to go as a pregnant nun. And then that'd be quite funny in some circles, to go into a costume party as a pregnant nun. But if you did that in a Buddhist country, that would be considered very obscene, very irreverent, very lewd kind of thing to do. In fact, in Thailand one time, I remember the British consul's wife went to a costume party wearing a bhikkhu's robe. It was a nice orange off-the-shoulder robe as a cocktail dress. And the Thais were so upset they forced her to leave the country. It was not considered funny. She was doing it as a kind of, you know, that might have been pretty, really smashing thing to have done in London cocktail circuit. But in Bangkok, that was just being insensitive and rude and sacrilegious. And I agree with the Thai view more than with the Western one. I think making fun and demeaning religious symbols and trivializing them is a very low thing to do, because one thing we really need to do is learn how to regain that sense of sacred, of the sacred, of devotion, of respect, not kind of blind belief, superstitious belief, but a respect for life and the symbols that point to the ultimate truth, and to have that quality of faith again in our lives, rather than just making wisecracks and being terribly clever and witty, terribly funny. But in that leaves us cold, doesn't it? Leaves us out in the cold. And no longer do we feel any great warmth, or do we create warmth? We just create a kind of inanities around us. This is not beautiful behavior, like spitting on the Buddha rupas, or just to show that we don't believe in things like that, like they do in Zen sometimes. It can go too far, though, devotion, to where your life is just nothing but a series of ceremonies and chants and endless, tedious kind of little things to do, in which you just get caught up in endless kind of ceremonies to in front of shrines and images, and to, then that can be blinding also. But through reflection, you can keep all this in perspective. Know how to relate to the to these symbols. How to use symbols, how to use conventions, religious conventions. Respect them. Even the devotional side of religion, say, that we may not be able to relate to, is still, that still oftentimes has something very good in it, much better than the kind of witty wisecracks and offhanded conceit of clever people who are lacking in those qualities of devotion. It's only when you open the heart and feel gratitude and respect that there's any kind of joyful experience in life. One can be incredibly clever with a vitriolic tongue, make incredibly funny jokes, wisecracks, say the most clever things, and be the life of the party, and still be completely cold-hearted, miserable, neurotic person. I'm not criticizing Zen either, but oftentimes people's interpretation of these things, a kind of irreverence that oftentimes is considered proof that you're not attached to anything, is what Westerners find attractive. Those Zen stories about punching the Roshi in the gut, or whatever. The different kind of stories that make it sound that you can, that you don't have to, that it's merely by being irreverent that you realize that you have a enlightenment, just to prove that you're not attached to Roshis or to symbols or traditions or ceremonies. But that's just the reverse of the other. Contempt and irreverence is just the reverse of attachment to rites and rituals. Still silapatta paramasa, still an obstacle to stream entry. The silapatta paramasa, to be free from that, from belief in rites and rituals, doesn't mean in disbelieving in them, but in no longer misusing them. Either by blindly attaching or by blindly rejecting them. You find in Britain and in America also groups that don't want any of Buddhism. They don't want to be called Buddhists, and they don't want Buddha images or Buddha anything. They want only Dhamma. And they don't want Sangha either. They want just Dhamma. Well, that's a very idealistic approach. It's like starting at the top, where it's like the Unitarians in the Christianity, or the kind of very idealistic religious groups that start out with the purest, the finest, and then because of that they think anything less than that has to be totally rejected. So, but when you contemplate, though, you find that reflection, contemplation, you need Buddha to do that. The Dhamma alone is too idealistic. You need to bring the actual reflection to the present moment through awaken, through being awake, not through trying to be enlightened or trying to just believe in some kind of view of Dhamma. Because otherwise you just create a belief of Dhamma rather than a knowing of Dhamma. So Buddha is in the reflective, the reflection of being awake to the way things are. Knowing how things are is Buddha. So that then the Buddha say, he who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha, and he who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. These are kind of like just two aspects of the same thing. They support each other, they help each other, and one doesn't cancel out the other. And as a human being, we have to contemplate from this position of separation, of being a human being limited and bound into a human body on a planet. In order to do that, the symbol of Buddha is a very helpful symbol for reflection, because Buddhas are like this, aren't they? They're personifications of wisdom. So the Buddha Rupa is not just an abstracted kind of awakened one in some very kind of without any form at all, because you don't want the human form to be, you don't want to be seen bowing to golden images, idols, as many people think we do. But the actual human being in the state of being awake, alert, enlightened, is something that we can, when we see that, then we tend to incline to that, put ourselves into that mode, into that posture. Even our robes are similar in style to the robes on the Buddha image. We copy, don't we, the postures, the hand mudra, how the feet are, so forth. The Buddha images are in the sitting, standing, walking, lying down postures, the four postures that we use. When we see Buddha images, when we do that, that reminds us. And so that reminding, that puts it into the mind again. We remember, we recollect Buddha. We tend to incline in that direction towards being more Buddha-like, if we use the symbol in the right way. Of course, some people just see Buddha rupas as aesthetic kind of objects that one can develop one's critical faculties around, with the best styles and the most graceful images, and who produces the best and so forth, and have a whole history of the history of the Buddha Rupa. But that I would avoid, actually. I'd avoid getting into aesthetics over Buddha Rupas. Just more or less see them as reminders of Buddha, rather than dwelling on the kind of their beauty or their aesthetic qualities. Dhamma. The Buddha reflects all conditions that arise cease. Sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe dhamma anatta. Recollects, contemplates this, reflects on the way it is. So we put ourselves in this mode of being, this Buddha mode, where we're awake, we're alert, we're attentive, the mind is open, receptive, clear, knowing things as they are. All that arises ceases, all dhamma is not self. And then the refuge of Sangha is the Supatipanno, Ujjupatipanno, Yayapatipanno, Samijipatipanno. So this means you and myself doing this with integrity, with honesty, sincerity, directness. Putting this into practice as this being here, as this man or this woman in these robes, as Sangha rather than as personalities, as men or as women or as Americans or as British or as upper class or working class or black or white or young or old or fascinating or stupid or whatever. These things are not no longer the identities in Sangha. Sangha is the way of cutting through all that toward the Ujjupatipanno, Supatipanno, Ujjupatipanno, Yayapatipanno, Samijipatipanno. Now this is in a real practical way of beginning to surrender and let go of the very conditions which cause inequality, injustice, unfairness, intolerance, isn't it? If you really appreciate Sangha, it gives you the chance. It doesn't mean that we're all going to be exactly the same. It's like one exact bhikkhu is exactly the same as another, no difference. It means that the differences are no longer the priority. They're subdued, they're let go of. A universal mind. You can perceive yourself as just this little being here. The perception of me and mine. I'm this body. I'm Sumeto Bhikkhu. I'm this way. I'm that way. According to the habit of perceiving self, it'd be just that much. I could just attached to a very miserable view of myself and hold on to that, and wherever I am, I'm a worthless, rotten so-and-so, I'm no good. One bhikkhu I know used to say, always wherever you go, there's a kind of constant background, perpetual blokey of I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good. Wherever he went, this seemed to be carrying on, this kind of inner voice, accusing, always interjecting into the moment, this kind of view. And of course, if you believe that, then of course one tends to see from that narrow and small, unsatisfactory perception. Now you become what you believe in. If you, what you believe you are, you become like that. So that because of that ability to become, we take refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha in the kind of ultimate refuges that you could possibly conceive of. As far as our ability to conceive of things, what is more kind of perfect than a Buddha? Even the Brahma gods pale in contrast to the Buddha. Even the most radiant, fantastically beautiful Brahmas, with all their serene and radiant qualities, seem trivial to the Buddha, the knowing, the wise one. And you think of some absolutely fantastic Brahma god, is just sending out radiant light from his head, and these beautiful diamond crowns and gold and jewels and lights, and sounds a bit much, doesn't it? Compared to the cool clarity, wisdom of a Buddha. So you're taking the, what is, for our human ability to conceive the ultimate attainment as a human being is, as a god, in fact, because he's a teacher of gods and men, is a Buddha. So that you reflect that that is the highest possible thing that one could ever imagine or conceive of as a human, in our human situation. Then with Dhamma, that includes everything. Your mind, as far as a concept goes, you can't be one up on that word, Dhamma. There's no word that could be more inclusive than Dhamma. It includes everything. They say kusla dhamma pyakata tamma sukhaya vedanaya and so forth. All the from the conditioned to the unconditioned. So Dhamma, you've taken the ability to conceive to its highest point, to where it's all inclusive, completely and utterly inclusive. And then with Sangha, the Supatipanno, Ujjupatipanno, Yayapatipanno, Samijipatipanno, that you have what? The human being in a flesh and blood form like this creature here, doing what is possible for any human being to do. It's not asking me to fly up into the air, to walk on the water, to do anything miraculous like Superman, or to send forth lights from my head and get rid of all the evil demons or anything fantastic, is it? One who is sincere and earnest and good and straight and proper and that kind of thing. The ultimate attainment of a human being, how to be that which is say Sangha, is the concept of the fulfillment and perfection of the human condition. So you've got these three refuges as the kind of, that's conceptualization, taking it to its finest, to its ultimate. You can't really surpass those concepts with other, you might you might more or less add to them with the subcategories or something, but those are the ultimate ones of human thought. They're concepts, aren't they? They're still concepts, but because of that you've taken thought to the limit of thinking, then you don't have to. There's no point in trying to think beyond that, but toward the actual practice and reflection, being awake and knowing, rather than trying to endlessly think about things. Because you need to understand the limit of thought and how far it can take you. It can take you that far. You can conceive the best, the ultimates, but to actually know, say, is different than conceiving. Conception. Knowing is in this way of Buddha knowing, Buddha knowledge is in reflecting on the way it is. Sabbe sangharanicca, sabbe dhammanatta. Now, with our personalities, these can be, these are all kinds of qualities and variations of mediocrity and brilliance and stupidity and so forth, can't they? Some of the things that go through our minds and things we do and say and have done or have said are hardly supatipanno uju or yaya or samiji. They can be just foolish and silly, meaningless reactions to life, just out of fear and desire. We can think down to, we can actually become like pretas, just sinking down to the lowest level of human behavior. Just food, sex, and sleep, and violence, and just, like the lower realms. Where all you're doing is just eating and sleeping and promiscuous sex, just exploitation of sexuality and violence, drugs and drink and all this. Many people do. Many people do that. They just get caught up with taking the lowest possible standard to exist on, to be degraded and demeaned. That's possible to sink to the lower realms. Now the refuges allow us to, because of that. That is the kind of the ultimate for a human conception. Then it gives us the inspiration, the courage to rise up in just this moment. You don't, if you're idealistic, then you try to rise up as a kind of, as if you could do it just by wishing you could, or by having the holding on to the idea of rising up. But rising up is a continuous process, because the food, sex, and desire and all these things will pull us down all the time. The body, with its age and sickness and instinctual nature and demands, will keep drawing us down if you don't rise up. So rising up is something that is our practice, to rise up to the occasion, leaping out of bed with alacrity at 3 in the morning, doing things, rising up to great acts of generosity, or of just being on time, of just being sensitive and open, of being alert to the needs of a community and of being considerate. This takes a rising up, doesn't it? We have to rise to the occasions to open our hearts to others and to do what is right and good for the welfare of others. Because if we to just sink into to immature habit, emotional states, just selfishness, leave me alone, don't bother me, and just for just trying to get what you can for survival, food, sex, and sleep, distracting yourself with drugs and drink, doping it all up, and just what good are you to anybody? You're just something that has you've misused, rejected the opportunity for, say, enlightenment in this lifetime. So I see very much now that life is a continuous rising up, rather than, and if you don't do it, because of the nature of sensuality, if you don't rise to the occasions of life, then you're going to sink. You don't stay in one place. There's no kind of abiding place in the samsara where you can just kind of stay static. And a refuge in samsara where you're just going to stay and be safe without sinking down. Because if you don't rise up, you'll sink down. It's like your body, isn't it? It grows up and then it grows down, grows old. You can't hold on to it and make it stay, say, at its peak of youthful vigor and beauty. As soon as it reaches that point where it's at its peak of maturity and beauty and vigor, then what does it do? It starts going down, getting old. That's the nature of the body. That's the nature of all sensuality, sense conditions. They do that so that it's just the way it is. All that arises ceases. So identity with sensuality will always bring that, you will always be in that state of becoming, because when things start getting going down, then you have to go try to become something else, rather than the rising up I'm talking about is not becoming, but opening the mind to being alert, awake to the way things are, rather than being pulled by the way things seem to be. And being pulled along by the appearance and by the way things seem to be is the path of least resistance, isn't it? If out of ignorance and stupidity, not recollecting, not seeing things as they really are, it's easy to just get caught in a mood or desires and fears. It's the path of least resistance just to follow those things, because they can be so strong, so powerful, that to rise up to them, to embrace them, to bear them, is something that takes, at first seems like an enormous effort. Because all one wants to do is, say, get rid of them, run away from them. But as we change more and more toward that full-mindedness, where all conditions arise and cease, then we begin to realize what deathlessness is. What is born dies and is not self. There's no soul, no self in anything that is born. And therefore anything that dies is not anything, the soul or a person. It's just merely the end of something that was born. It arises in the mind and ceases in the mind. Like Sister Dasania is in the mind. Well, you probably think her mind's in her body, don't you? You say, how's your mind these days, Sister Dasania? Do you feel happy or depressed? Are you thinking about the mood or the thought in the brain? Maybe or the body. The body, you think of the mind in the body. But from the right view, one sees that the body's in the mind. All these bodies are in the mind. But it seems to be, and the way we tend to believe, and the perceptions we have, is that our mind is in the body. Body and mind, nama rupa, mind. Where's your mind? It's here. We point to our head, because we tend to be attached to thoughts and ideas. They say to Thai, where's your mind? They point here, in the heart. That's where you feel, the emotional. You feel love and hate here, don't you? You don't love and hate up here. This is more like computer. It's just a discriminative kind of function of mind. But here is where you feel attraction and aversion and all the kind of big feelings. So you have, when you're talking about love and all that, you're talking about the heart. Just in modern English slang, we talk about sweethearts. My sweetheart. You're not thinking of your brain then, are you? Sweet brain. You would call your girlfriend sweet brain. They're somebody with a lot of heart. It's different than somebody with a lot of brains, isn't it? So we do. We do see the mind as either the heart, the emotions, or the ideas of the brain. The discriminative, the kind of computer-like knowledge of the brain. But those are conditions of the mind. Now we're going to the full mind, the mind ground, beyond the conditions, where conditions cease. Where the conditions cease, rather than trying to hold on to the conditions. We let all the conditions go, and they all take us to mostly the brain and the heart. The conditions that come from the brain and the heart cease in the mind. So where's the mind? So the mind is the knowing, being the knowing. Knowing that whatever subject to arising is subject to ceasing, in all Dhamma, you can't find anything, anything at all that is self. Which is not saying that there's no self, is there? It's just saying you can't find self. then what's left? It's pushing you to that complete exploration of human existence, so that you know it in all its facets. You've explored, you've witnessed, you've gone to the very limits of conceptualization and of feeling, of where things arise and cease, to emptiness. Are you one who knows the way it is? This is what I'm trying to get across to you, this opportunity here in Amaravati, to do this, not to just spend your time just trying to suppress thoughts or concentrate the mind on one thing, but to actually explore consciousness to its limits, so you know. And the teaching of the Buddha is very precise, very clear, very helpful for that. Because then you cannot be deluded by anything, if you know that. You cannot ever be deluded and caught up in the foolishness of the appearance. Because the appearances can be so foolish. In our time now, there's so much foolishness in the world, so much stupidity and ignorance in the amongst humanity, amongst human beings on this planet. So many kind of extreme things, and all of it can be so kind of overwhelming, so terrifying. Daily news now is usually of the most horrendous kind of reports of atrocities and terrorism that the human beings are carrying on while we're sitting here in this shrine room. Imagine right now, probably somebody's being beaten to death or tortured or blown up or some place on this planet, the horrors that go on, and the wrong views. The ignorance is everywhere, because people, most human beings, have not taken the time, had the opportunity. Maybe they would take the time if they had the opportunity, but they haven't had, most people haven't had an opportunity for this kind of reflection, where you can actually penetrate and see, getting beyond doubt, into the truth of the way it is.